The Raffays were a Pakistani-Canadian immigrant family who moved to Bellevue, Washington while their son Atif finished his freshman year at Cornell University. Atif's father, Dr. Tariq Raffay, was a prominent and outspoken moderate Muslim with controversial views in their old community in Vancouver. While Atif and his best friend Sebastian Burns were out for the night on July 12, 1994, Atif's father, mother, and sister were brutally bludgeoned to death in their home. Neighbors on either side of the Raffays' home independently reported hearing the sounds of the murders at a time for which the boys' whereabouts were well known. Their full cooperation revealed no incriminating evidence. DNA evidence, mixed with Dr. Raffay's blood, belonged to neither the victims nor Atif or Sebastian. Yet, despite all of this, as well as compelling leads implicating religious extremists, the Bellevue police never took their focus off of Atif and Sebastian. While the boys went up to live with Sebastian's parents in Canada, investigators enlisted the help of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to perform an undercover sting called Mr. Big that extracted two false confessions that were riddled with inconsistencies and contradictions. To solidify their case, they coerced Atif and Sebastian's friend, Jimmy Miyoshi, to give a third inconsistent statement. When expert testimony on false confessions as well as the evidence of other possible suspects were ruled inadmissible, the jury was only able to weigh the inconsistent false confessions against the physical evidence and eyewitness accounts that clearly contradicted them. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. And wow, I mean, where do I even start? Because this case should have gone in an entirely different direction with what came from the initial investigation. But they took the really long, borderline crazy way around the right answer to get to this one. It's so convoluted. And luckily with us today to help tell the story, we have a true hero of the innocence movement. And of course, I'm talking about Ken Klonsky. Ken is the director of Innocence International, an organization that he co-founded with a legend, a boxing legend and a civil rights legend, a man whose name you'll probably recognize, Reuben Hurricane Carter. So Ken, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here.
Today, we are compelled to shine a light on the horrendous case of Atif Raffay and Sebastian Burns, two 19-year-old boys back then, 27 years ago, they were 19, who were egregiously framed, persecuted in the court system and in the press. Atif is with us today. Sebastian can't be, unfortunately. But the case, I want to be clear, they're both equally innocent and they're both framed in the exact same proceedings.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Atif Raffay,
an inmate at Monroe Correctional Complex. This call will be recorded and monitored.
So on the phone with us now, calling in from prison in Washington State, where he's been locked up for a triple murder he had nothing to do with, is my friend and personal hero, Atif Raffay. Atif, I'm sorry you have to be here under these conditions, but hopefully not for too much longer. But I am happy you're here, and thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Jason. I'm so grateful.
So, Atif, your story was covered by Kelly Loudenberg in the Confession Tapes on Netflix. And in a series that was one episode per case, yours, she actually dedicated two episodes to it. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. So let's start by going back to a time before this unspeakable tragedy befell your family. What was life like for you growing up?
It was a remarkably happy and lucky life, I would think, in almost every respect. I grew up partly in Karachi, Pakistan, but most of my life I lived in Vancouver, and I had amazing, devoted, wonderful parents. I mean, my parents were extraordinary people, and I didn't merely just love them, I admired them. My mom was a best friend to me. My dad was the kind of person who cared deeply about everything in the world and was able to continuously engage me in being interested in the world in a way that I think few people ever get to experience. It was a real enormous privilege to grow up like that and to be able to have the parents I did.
So no one ever even claimed that there were any problems of any kind in your family, that there were any bad feelings, much less violence or strife. And I also want to highlight that your father, Dr. Tariq Rafay, was a prominent Sunni Muslim and was active in his religious and cultural communities, both in Vancouver and Bellevue, only a 2.5-hour drive away from one another, by the way. He was the co-founder and one-time president of the very moderate interfaith friendship-building organization, the Pakistan-Canada Association, whose activities were, frankly, very upsetting to some more radical Muslims.
And it's important to note that Dr. Rafay also published a paper and developed a controversial computer program indicating that Muslims in British Columbia were mistakenly not facing Mecca when they prayed. The direction Muslims are meant to face is called Qibla, which is the direction of the shortest possible path from any place to Mecca. And it has all sorts of important implications. Not only daily prayers, but also Muslims are not permitted to urinate, spit, or stretch their feet in the direction of Mecca. And when dead, Muslims must be buried on their right-hand side to face Mecca. Now, much later, during Atif's trial, this controversy came up. And the prosecution misquoted Dr. Rafay's paper, stating that according to Dr. Rafay, the Qibla in use in the Pacific Northwest was only off by 1 degree. And how would anyone be angered by such a small degree? But the prosecutor had misquoted Dr. Rafay, who said that the true Qibla direction was 1 degree off from the North Pole, which would mean that Muslims praying in the Pacific Northwest were off by close to 100 degrees. So imagine a 90-degree turn and then 10 more degrees. And then imagine telling folks that their dead parents were facing the wrong direction forever.
So Atif, the night when your parents and sister were tragically killed was July 12, 1994. But you and your friend Sebastian Burns were heading out for the night while your mother, father, and sister stayed home. If you could give us the timeline for that night, where did you go and what did you do?
Sure. So it was in many ways a typical night for us as teenagers, going out to a diner, then going to the movies, and then afterwards searching for a club and going for a dessert. We had an early light dinner at the Keg restaurant from around 9 o'clock to about 9:30-ish. And at that time, we went over for the 9:50 showing of The Lion King. And so we were in the lobby for a while until the movie started at 9:50. They would play a large number of advertisements and trailers before the movie actually started. Those take several minutes. And then what happened that night was something quite unusual. The curtains closed after the advertisements and trailers were over, and The Lion King began and started to be projected over the closed curtain. And the movie went on like that for quite a while, enough so that Sebastian and I think some other patrons were in the audience got up and went and had to go get the manager. It took a while for them to get the movie restarted and the curtains opened again. And so, you know, it was probably 10:08 or something by the time all that was solved.
And that manager's name is Jose Martinez, who spoke with Sebastian and handled this projector and curtain issue. He could place you both in the theater at that time, as could the concessions employee, Jesse Kaplan, who's the guy who sold Sebastian his Kit Kat and talked with him about his t-shirt before the movie. Now, both men, Jose Martinez and Jesse Kaplan, distinctly recall you guys both in the lobby of the theater before the movie began and during this projector issue as well, because according to them, a Pakistani kid and a white guy with blonde hair made a notable pair.
So that covers Atif's and Sebastian's whereabouts from their arrival to the movie theater around 9:40 p.m. to at least 10:08 p.m. when the projector issue was fixed. Meanwhile, Atif's neighbors, Mark Seidel and Julie Rackley, who lived on either side of the Rafay household, whose houses were so close, in fact, that they had complained sometime of the volume of the Rafay's TV. They independently reported and later went on to testify that they heard the exact same sounds, describing them as a hammering or banging sound, but hollow and muffled sounding. And they heard those sounds comfortably in the window of time when Jose Martinez and Jesse Kaplan can place Atif and Sebastian in the lobby of the movie theater.
You just can't be in two places at once. It's making me crazy because you had just about as good of an alibi as you could possibly have. So now you've just seen The Lion King, right? And you hit a few other places, just a typical night that millions of teenagers have every weekend all over the country. Then you go home and find yourself in a literal horror scene.
So we got out of the car, not expecting anything unusual, walked into the living room, and I saw my mother lying in that room, and I could see stain on the carpet. And after that, I was in a daze. I rushed upstairs. Sebastian was rushing everywhere around too, and it's a confusion of disbelief and bewilderment. I went over to my dad's room. Even though the lights were off, I could see what the officers would later describe as what looked like a shotgun blast over the back wall. And it was, I was spinning around literally on my feet. I don't think I've ever really recovered from it. I felt frightened. I felt completely disoriented and in shock. Sebastian and I had just instinctively, I think, ran outside, and he had already called the police. I could hear him calling. And as soon as the first police officer arrived, Gary Romano, he actually drove past us while we were in the driveway. And we ran after them, trying to flag him down, and we had to actually pound on the trunk of the car because he was just driving off. And he got out and yelled at us to sit on the curb. I don't know whether he thought we were perpetrators or something, or somehow involved, but Gary Romano was very serious about us sitting down and being quiet, and I didn't know what to do other than to follow his directions. I think that changed the way everyone else looked at us and our behavior afterwards. I think the other detectives who came in would say they were not as emotional as we would expect. They were not as concerned as we would expect. We gave them every cooperation we could. We gave them all our clothes, our shoes, my glasses, fingerprints, and photographs. They did searches with lights, and they did a gunshot residue test. You know, I gave them carte blanche to search the house and do whatever else they wanted to do. They recorded statements. And then they bought us some sweats and dumped us off in the Bellevue Motel without a phone.
My assumption was always that they didn't want them to call a lawyer or Mr. Burns to get advice on what to do, but to keep them isolated.
Okay, so they've got you confined in this seedy motel room, poking and prodding you and Sebastian with a whirlwind of questions and examinations that you submitted to voluntarily, which lasted about 56 hours and turned up exactly nothing.
Neither did the physical evidence at the crime scene incriminate Atif or Sebastian, nor did the extensive testing that Atif and Sebastian voluntarily submitted to afterward. There was not a shred of bone, blood, tissue, or anything else found in either boy's body or clothing or in their hair. The idea that you could just shower away all of that blood evidence, it's pretty remote.
So they're pinning their hopes on the DNA test results to incriminate you two, because they had nothing else. But in the meantime, you're two teenage boys. I mean, let's face it, the responsible adults in your lives here in America, your parents were simply gone, right? Your sister was gone, and your house was a crime scene. You had no home here at all, right? Nowhere to go. And I mean, now put yourself in Sebastian's parents' shoes, right? They were definitely going to try like hell to get you and their son back to their home in Canada. And all of this was happening while funeral arrangements were being made by your extended family.
So at the time, I didn't realize this, but my relatives were actually flying in and coming into town. And they kept the fact that that was happening from us. Sebastian's parents had contacted the Canadian consulate, and the consulate contacted the police and informed them that they wanted to return us to Canada. And I left a message with Detective Thompson saying that we would be leaving. And on that very day, my relatives were in Seattle, but the police were not disclosing to them where we were or how to reach us, and they weren't telling us that they were even in town. And so on the day that I went back to Canada, I didn't even know what the police did know, which was that the funeral was already being arranged completely without my knowledge or participation, And this would later be something that the police would then lie about and describe us as fleeing the country.
They were seen as, I think, a couple of wise guys who'd gotten away with something.
So now they want to paint you as fleeing, right? Even though you had given them everything they'd asked for over the course of those 56 hours in that seedy motel room. Now, one of the other bizarre things about the prosecution's theory in this case was that Atif had wanted the insurance money from his parents. But even that, you would need to suspend a huge amount of disbelief because of the level of violence in these murders, and particularly of Atif's father, who the police estimated was bashed in the head 40 times with a baseball bat. And indications were and are that the first blow was the blow that ended Dr. Rafay's life. So why would a loving son, who now supposedly suddenly out for money, commit a murder in that manner?
The amount of violence done could only have indicated fanaticism to me.
So now, while they were still waiting on the DNA to incriminate you, or so they thought, more evidence was pouring in, pointing instead toward religious extremists. You'll remember Dr. Rafay's efforts to improve relations with other religious communities and his controversial views on Qibla. Okay, so in the days following the murders, the Bellevue police received not one, not two, but three tips from other law enforcement agencies. First, Constable Jalinas with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police told them that a confidential informant had warned them of a man who had been offered $20,000 to kill an East Indian family that had previously lived in Vancouver but had moved to Bellevue. The informant became aware of this 2 days before the murders were committed. Jalinas contacted investigators Robert Thompson and Jeff Gomes, the lead Bellevue officers on the case, who then traveled to Vancouver and knocked on the door of the man in question's home twice. He didn't answer either time, and the officers returned to the U.S. without making any contact. Secondly, the intelligence division of the Seattle Police had information that Al-Fukra, a radical and militant organization, may have been involved in the homicides, but they didn't bother to follow up on that tip either. And 5 days after the murders, another tip came in from the FBI, right? So RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Seattle Police Intelligence, and now the freaking FBI, they delivered an informant to Bellevue, and he told them that a militant Islamic faction to which he was privy said that Dr. Tariq Rafay should die because of his beliefs and teachings about the Quran. The informant also said that in the days after the murders, a member of this same militant faction came to his house and was worried that he, the informant, had seen a baseball bat that the militant and others had had in their car. Because of this concern, the FBI informant came to believe that the murder weapon was a bat. Now, the Bellevue police already knew the murder weapon was a bat, but that fact, critically, had not been made public yet.
This guy was a reliable FBI informant. The police were given full addresses, names, places of work, telephone numbers, and they just ignored him. They didn't even spell the names that he gave them correctly. All of this information never came to our attention till years later, because they said that they didn't have to turn over discovery until we were in the United States. And so for years, we didn't know about any of this information, and we couldn't investigate it.
So if all of these credible and compelling leads couldn't break through the Bellevue investigators' tunnel vision, I'm going to go ahead and guess that conflicting DNA test results probably wouldn't have made a difference either. So let's dive in. Investigators found DNA mixed with Dr. Rafay's blood in the downstairs shower, DNA mixed in with a bloody footprint in the garage made with Dr. Rafay's blood, as well as a coarse body hair or pubic hair on the parents' fitted sheet where Dr. Rafay's body was found. But none of the other DNA profiles that were discovered at the crime scene matched the DNA of the victims, Tariq Sultana or Basma Rafay, or the supposed alleged culprits in the case, Sebastian and Atif. So there's DNA evidence at the crime scene clearly excluding Atif and Sebastian and pointing at unknown perpetrators.
One more thing about that hair that you mentioned. The detectives initially, when they found it, said it was in a position that could only be explained if it had been left by the killer. And they kept saying that right until the DNA proved that it didn't belong to Sebastian or me.
More inconvenient truths. So if they had no evidence of your guilt, which they didn't, in fact, they had evidence of someone else's guilt, but they were fixed on getting you, then why not go ahead and make shit up, right? They pointed to books you had read and philosophy papers, saying that you two guys love Nietzsche and subscribe to his Superman theory, and in their slanted understanding, implied that you and Sebastian were capable of callously taking what you wanted from those who you deemed weaker than yourselves. Then they went after your alibi, saying that Sebastian ordered wine at the restaurant you had gone to that night, the Keg, so specifically so that he would be carded, right, in order to solidify his alibi. But what's wrong with this theory?
Well, we had fake ID, like most underage kids at that time, to get into clubs and to order drinks. But, you know, it had a different name on it. Edward Montero, Eduardo Montero. So I'm not sure how that would help us exactly.
Right. For that theory about being remembered to hold water, you'd have to have ID that wasn't fake, not ID that was. And then they attacked your alibi again, saying that you left a larger than usual tip just to be remembered. Okay. $15 on a bill of $9.50. And if you think that's too much, and of course it is more than 20%, but try asking your server or bartender what they usually do when they go out. They're usually very generous to one another. And Sebastian used to be a server.
Sebastian liked to leave tips. He had been a server. He knew how much that meant to them. You're going to tell a server to keep the change. You're not going to just give them a 50-cent tip because you have 10 even and your bill's $9.50. You're going to give them the next bill you have.
Which I guess in this case was a $5. But obviously this is all really weak. And with the physical evidence all pointing away from you, plus all the media hype around your case, they had to come up with something. So it's January 1995, months after the murders. You're both in Canada, and Bellevue investigators enlist the help of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to perform a sting operation that was illegal in the U.S., but legal in Canada. And it was known as Mr. Big.
The Mr. Big technique involves undercover officers playing roles as gangsters, thus gaining the trust of a police target. They seduce the target with a gangster mystique and the promise of big money schemes. They eventually ask about the target's criminal history under the guise of knowing whether any past criminal behavior poses a risk to future criminal operations that they're going to perform together. For example, you know, will you turn on me if you get pinched? And then, as with other methods of eliciting confessions, and Jason, your network has covered this extensively on your show, Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions, the results are a mixed bag. Some reliable confessions, some false. And the most reliable way one can tell the difference is by the evidence that does or does not corroborate the statements made by police targets.
Now, in this case, the operation begins with setting up electronic and visual surveillance of the targets, which included Atif, Sebastian, and their friend Jimmy Miyoshi.
And it's important to note that the authorities knew Jimmy wasn't even in the area at the time of the murders, but they were leaning on him as an alleged accomplice either before or after the killing. They would take either.
So the game begins. And over time, there's a chance meeting. Oh, well, it's not really a chance meeting between Sebastian and these undercover agents. And a slow seduction process begins into making him believe in their assumed criminal identities. They let Sebastian in on some staged meetings and some fake victimless scenarios, like moving a car he had been told was stolen. And then with a toxic mix of trust and fear, they hope to elicit a confession. So this seduction process went on for about 4 months, and there's been talk about the murder in Bellevue, but Sebastian repeatedly denied it. Then, around May through July, things start to come to a head.
I had nothing to do with the undercover officers at first. I knew Sebastian was getting involved with them. He was telling me about it. But by May 6th, Sebastian didn't want to have anything to do with them. Every time Sebastian tried to say, I don't want to have anything to do with you, he would say, who are you going to give up when the police come and arrest you? And I know from my inside information that the police are come to arrest you. And Sebastian would say, well, they must be fabricating something. They must be misrepresenting something. It can't be the case because we didn't do the crime.
Now, if you're speaking to a police officer, you have the right not to incriminate yourself. You can plead the Fifth Amendment. But if you're speaking to gangsters, it's far more intimidating because you can't plead the Fifth Amendment with these gangsters. You're afraid of what they're going to do to you or your family.
And it didn't matter whether we thought or we were worried that we were about to be arrested, because what mattered was what Mr. Big believed. And he kept saying that what he believed is that we were being arrested, and that our being arrested was putting him in danger. And he says, I'm not going to take the risk of going down. You have to remember that. You have to satisfy me that I can get rid of all the evidence that's down there so that you don't go to jail, so that you're not putting my organization at risk.
It's a corner that they paint you into from which there is no escape unless you do what they say.
And to be clear, Atif and Sebastian never really came out and said, we killed them and this is how we did it. What passed as a confession came from the bogus answers to the undercover agent's questions. Questions that were aimed at filling in the large gaps in this investigation that had so far pointed away from Atif and Sebastian. For example, about how they had covered their tracks. And these bogus answers that Atif and Sebastian ended up giving to these questions are what ended up passing for an admission of guilt.
For example, when Sebastian was asked about what you guys did with the bloody clothing, he said, we threw them in a dumpster. Which one? I can't remember. Well, what happens when they find it? Panicked, he came up with, no, we threw each piece of clothing out in different dumpsters. You know, so two socks, two shoes, pants, underwear, shirt, that's seven pieces of clothing each. How many dumpsters could you even find in Bellevue, right? You'd need to have a Google map of dumpsters, which didn't exist back then. These are just childish lies. The next time the undercover agent asked him about the bloody clothing, he changed his story again. No, we did it naked. So there were no bloody clothes. But then there were also no bloody footprints leading to the shower or blood that had dripped off of their supposedly naked bodies. It's a miracle. Then later on, when they ask you, Atif, the same question about the disposal of any bloody clothing, you said, oh, we just huck them out the window. So now that's four different fucking stories just about the clothing. Then there's the utter nonsense with the murder weapon, the baseball bat, right? Where'd you get it? Well, first Sebastian said it was just laying around the Rafay household. I mean, I'm not sure if you can speak for all Pakistanis, Atif, but isn't cricket more of the usual thing?
We play cricket in Pakistan. I've never played baseball in any form whatsoever.
The next time, Sebastian comes up with a completely different lie, which is that you guys bought the bat, the murder weapon, in a sporting goods store. But which store? He couldn't remember. Where? Doesn't know.
The undercover agents also asked Sebastian about how they were able to commit these murders if they were at the movie theater. And he said, oh, we left by the side door. And no one ever bothered to demonstrate how impossible it would be to commit the murders during the time frame supplied by the neighbors. So again, another implausible answer is given to please these gangsters.
So there's only one reason why these stories contradicted the facts and each other. And that's because they were all made up stories. You would have literally needed to rehearse this because there's no way that the two different minds are going to come up with the same story independently when the whole story is made up out of whole cloth.
Right. I mean, we tried our best to provide a plausible story. But yes, we didn't come up with perfect stories because we didn't commit the murders and we couldn't keep our story straight because we didn't practice them well enough.
Okay, so eventually you're arrested. July 31st, 1995, you and Sebastian are charged with three counts of aggravated first-degree murder, and your friend Jimmy Miyoshi was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. And you guys were locked up in maximum security pre-trial facilities in BC, British Columbia, for 6 years. And in the fall of 95, Jimmy Miyoshi was threatened by the RCMP with a suggestion that he might face the death penalty if he didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, which is that you guys were guilty. So understandably scared for his life, Jimmy signed an immunity agreement from his charge of conspiracy to commit murder and provided a number of statements that incriminated you guys. But again, we see the same pattern. Each statement contradicted the last one, and each one of them contradicted the physical evidence at the crime scene. So how many times did Jimmy initially deny that you and Sebastian had anything to do with it?
Jimmy denied it 24 times. And even after he made statements that were necessary to get an immunity agreement, he contacted our attorneys, and he tried to find a way to tell the truth without being punished for it. Prosecutors found out he was working for Lehman Brothers and put pressure on Lehman Brothers. He was told he was going to be fired unless he fulfilled his obligations to the prosecutors. And then he was told he might face murder charges in addition. So Jimmy did what everyone does, I think, in a system that's designed to make people say what the prosecutors want you to say. Jimmy did, in fact, go through with fulfilling his agreement, and then Lehman fired him anyway.
So after 6 years in a Canadian maximum security facility, in March of 2001, you were finally extradited to the United States. And in the lead up to trial in January of 2003, something both horrifying and what should have been like the final alarm sounding your innocence occurred. If you remember, Atif's father, Dr. Rafay, co-founded and led a Muslim group in Vancouver that sought to build bridges with other faith communities. Well, his co-founder and successor in leading that group, Riyasat Ali Khan, was murdered.
He was murdered on his doorstep, very close to the eve of the trial. Maybe it was a message, the killing of Riyasat Ali Khan, that A, we still are here and we're going to do what we can to keep these religions apart, and B, you have the wrong people. You're prosecuting the wrong people.
Finally, the trial began November 23rd, 2003, over 8 years after the original arrests. But the trial, in some ways, was as messed up as the rest of this nightmare scenario. I mean, when I say that, the trial judge, Charles Mertel, ruled key evidence inadmissible. So the jury never learned about the leads that were provided to the Bellevue police by the FBI or the Seattle Intelligence Division informants. And those leads, for obvious reasons, would have been essential to prove your innocence, as well as introduce the element of religious extremism that would have, again, been absolutely compelling to any jury. But they weren't permitted to hear that. And they also weren't permitted to hear from Dr. Richard Leal. He's a leading expert on false confessions. He had agreed to present information regarding the false confessions that took place in order to provide the jury with relevant and reliable social scientific information about the psychological phenomenon of interrogation and false confessions so the jury could make an informed decision. The judge somehow determined that it was, quote, the province of this jury to decide whether or not in their common experience and common sense, these statements made by these defendants to these undercover officers are voluntary or involuntary. You were doomed. At that point, you were doomed.
All the trial counsel, including my own and the judge, were convinced that everything could be admitted from Canada on a silver platter without any American constitutional scrutiny. They were wrong about that, but that wasn't discovered till years after the trial.
Wow. So this technique that was illegal in the States, but legal at the time in Canada, was just sort of greenlit right in. And that is, of course, the only evidence in this case against you. I say that because, as I mentioned, the prosecution did present the ridiculous brain fart about the fake IDs, the large tip, and the Nitschke nonsense to try to bolster the false confessions, which they knew ran directly counter to the physical evidence, DNA evidence, alibi witnesses, and eyewitness accounts of the neighbors, as well as the leads that they didn't bother to follow up on involving religious extremists who were in all likelihood the real killers in this case. But it's really hard to overcome confession evidence, no matter how many inconsistencies and contradictions there are. So now, at this point, it's nearly 10 freaking years after your family was murdered, and the jury came to what was probably a predictable conclusion, a guilty verdict. And you and Sebastian were sentenced to serve 3 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. Tell us about that moment.
I don't think anything's as bad as the moment that I came home that night, but that was certainly a close second. Even after everything that happened in the trial, I didn't expect it. I believed somehow the jury would still be able to see that we were innocent. I was shocked.
Okay, so you've already been in jail for a decade. Now you're sent to prison. But you've continued, you know, your dedication to constantly learning and improving and growing.
I was very fortunate to find myself amongst some prisoners who were really interested in education and a great volunteer named Carol Estes who wanted to found a University Beyond Bars program here. And so I was able to spend some of my time actually contributing to that and helping other people learn, which felt satisfying and meaningful.
and now, you know, multiple college education programs. Did you still working on and through University Beyond Bars, on Loop, working on your undergraduate thesis, honors thesis from film, philosophy, and literature? It's extraordinary. So much more than so many people on the outside have or ever will do. So let's talk about your appeals and your prospects for freedom.
Atif's appeals were underway by the time we got involved. I had seen a film made by Sebastian's sister, Tiffany, and Reuben Hurricane Carter and I were obviously floored by the facts here. And we joined David Koch, the appeals lawyer, in support of Sebastian and Atif. And I actually attended his state appeal to a 3-judge panel in Seattle. And this was early on. I mean, we thought this would be a slam dunk. There's no forensic evidence, no alternative suspects allowed to be brought into the courtroom. There's no allowance of Richard Leo, who was an expert on false confessions. And Michael Levine, who was an expert on FBI sting operations, he wasn't allowed into the courtroom either. It was as if Judge Mertel had simply decided, we're going to convict these guys in a kangaroo court. But it didn't seem to matter how much sense our arguments made, as Atif and Sebastian were seen as guilty in the state of Washington. And the media coverage really made sure they were never going to receive a fair shake. And then Atif later got married to Loretta Fisher, who worked tirelessly on his behalf. And more appeals were filed on the back of her work, also to no avail. Then the Supreme Court of Canada ruled to limit the admissibility of evidence obtained through the Mr. Big operation. So now, even in Canada, where this evidence was conjured up, the admissibility of these confessions was brought into question, where in the absence of forensic evidence, as was the case here, these so-called confessions would not now be any longer admissible. And that should have been huge, but sadly, it was not.
There was a period when I didn't know where to turn, really. And out of the blue, Kelly Loudenberg decided to make my case the first one in her series of false confession documentaries. And Ken told me that someone who had watched the confession tapes had become so indignant and so impassioned about the case that she reached out to the person that everyone who knows about him thinks about first, and that's you, Jason.
Okay, so I know who you're talking about, but are you at liberty, do you feel comfortable telling us about this amazing mystery woman?
So Lakin is someone with whom I didn't know her before last year. And now she's become someone very special to me, whom I talk every day. And it's because of her that you got involved. And of course, it's because of her getting you involved that David Kim got involved. And David Kim has been a force of nature in my case. He wrote a 702-page analysis of this case that found things in it that even I hadn't found, and I thought I'd looked over absolutely everything in my case. And then, because he thought I needed the best appellate attorney in the United States, he reached out to Tom Goldstein, who's considered by everyone to be the 10th Supreme Court Justice, and certainly Google chose him as their lawyer when they needed to win a case at the Supreme Court of the United States. And it was a miracle to me when Tom got involved. And then Lars Zarofsky, who leads the Washington Innocence Project, became involved in my case. All these things just have been building over the last year, and that has completely transformed how I view the future now.
Amen to that. And now we're all awaiting the habeas corpus proceedings in the Ninth Circuit Court in the United States District for the Western District of Washington. So there's a lot of stuff going on. We're going to keep our audience apprised of it. We're going to link to the petition, Use Your Power, Let's Help Atif and Sebastian Get Home. There's also a website, RafeBurnsAppeal.com. All of it will be linked in the bio. So Ken and Atif, this is the part of the show that I know I look forward to the most, and I think our audience does as well. It's called Closing Arguments. It's the part of the show where I first of all have the privilege of thanking both of you for joining me and sharing this unbelievable story. And how this works is I'm going to turn my microphone off and leave yours both on and kick back in my chair and just listen to whatever you have to say, anything we haven't covered, anything you want to say at all about anything. And of course, Atif, we're going to save you the best for last. All due respect to you, Ken. So, yeah. So Ken, let's go to you first, and then you can just hand the mic off to Atif, and I'm just going to sit back and listen.
So as I said before, this case came to us as a result of the movie that Sebastian Burns' sister did back in 2007. It was at the Vancouver International Film Festival, and I happened to be in the audience. I saw this and realized that the Burnses were in the audience. They had been introduced. So I went up to them and I said, I'm working for Reuben Hurricane Carter, and I think this case would be of interest to him. Do you want some help? And of course they did. And so I got this case in front of Reuben, and he was infuriated by the way a pair of teenagers had been manipulated by people who should have known better, but were trying to burnish their own reputations. And to me, this story is really about friendships, both the one that Atif and Sebastian shared, as well as the one between the Muslim community and other faith-based communities in Canada that Dr. Tariq Rafay and later Riyasat Ali Khan tried to foster, an endeavor for which they paid with their lives. Well, the potential of these two young friends and the greater friendship between those communities, both were snuffed out.
Atif Rafay, over to you.
Sebastian and I have been wrongly imprisoned for over 27 years. I'm the same age today my parents were when I was a kid, when they were raising me. I imagine looking back in my life with their eyes. And every day has been a struggle to keep going, and I still hardly believe all that has happened. But what I feel most now is gratitude, amazingly enough. When I was a child, my parents told me stories about the hard times they had in their early years in Vancouver, when my dad was looking for work, how they would eat boiled potatoes off newspapers spread on the floor. And I understood when I was a kid that life would involve struggle. But I didn't fathom then just how much the caring and generosity of others would mean for my life, that this groundswell of support would make it possible for my struggle to matter still today. I owe so many people so much, not only Reuben and Ken and Tom and you, Jason, all of you people who are like Oscar Schindler, you know, in our day and age of wrongful convictions and mass incarceration. That feeling of gratitude is what carries me through every day. And I'm just grateful to have had the opportunity to feel that love and care for someone, for some small life.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Justin Golden, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis. The music on this show, as always, is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.